Hello and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Little Atoms is a show with an agenda, which is pro the Enlightenment. That means things like freedom of expression, free inquiry, scepticism, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. And not things like superstition, religious fundamentalism, totalitarianism, censorship and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And our guest on tonight's show is Professor Donna Dickinson. Donna Dickinson is the first woman recipient of the International Spinoza Lens Award for her contribution to public debate on ethics. She is Emeritus Professor of Medical Ethics and Humanities at the University of London and formerly John Ferguson Professor of Global Ethics at the University of Birmingham. Donna has written a number of books, but tonight we'll be discussing Body Shopping, which is her first popular book on science and medicine. I'm talking on the phone to Professor Donna Dickinson, who's the author of the book Body Shopping. Donna, thanks very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
First of all, I think before we get into some of the actual issues and stories that are in the book, I think we should perhaps have a discussion of some of the philosophical and legal issues that underpin a lot of the stories, in that most people listening would probably be surprised by the idea that, legally speaking, we can't actually be said to own our own bodies.
Yes, I think people really are very shocked when they find that out. I mean, I tell a lot of stories in the book, some of which are also shocking, but I found that the thing that shocks people most is this fact that in the common law we weren't held to own our bodies once tissue had left our bodies. So we're talking about tissue that's been removed, say, in the course of an operation, and what can be done with it afterwards. And there was a case which established this, that this was true in the common law, which is, you know, the law of the English-speaking countries. It was an American case, but it would also apply to this country. And it was a case called Moore, in which a man who had his spleen removed because he had leukemia, and the spleen was really had to come out. It was very much enlarged, 20 times its normal size. He was asked afterwards by his surgeon to keep coming back and donate other kinds of tissue. So he was asked to donate blood and sperm and hair and various kinds of tissue. And he said, well, do I have to do this? And was told, yes, this is really necessary for your treatment. And at one point he began to get suspicious. I think this was the point at which he was asked to take a form which said, I understand I will have no future rights in any products that may be derived from my tissue. He'd been ticking this quite happily until a certain point when he began to become suspicious. So he ticked, no, I don't agree with that. The form came back, please tick correctly. And it was obvious something was wrong. So he went to a lawyer and he discovered that his clinician and the hospital which employed him and a research firm which was involved as well had taken out a $3 billion cell line created from his spleen and his other tissues. And Moore was suitably outraged and went to court to try to establish rights in the cell line. And he did this not so much because he wanted the money as because he felt he hadn't given his consent and basically he felt he'd been exploited. And the court held that he had no rights in the cell line because it held that he had no ongoing property rights in his tissue once it had left his body, and that the work which had been put into developing the cell line by Moore's clinician, Dr. Gold, and his employer had actually been what made the cell line valuable, not Moore's own contribution. Now, this case has since been echoed in a number of other similar cases. So it establishes that in the common law, at least, tissue, once it's left the body, is what's called no one's thing. This may seem odd because you may say, well, isn't it Dr. Gold's thing? Isn't that the point of the judgment, you know? And yes, I think that's true. I think that is odd. But it does establish that it is not the tissue. The tissue does not belong to the donor. And I think most people do find this very odd and really quite distressing.
There's a concept there that you've sort of vaguely mentioned, which, and we'll get onto more a bit later when we talk about patents in more detail. But there's this idea of the concept of work, about who puts the work into a thing. So perhaps could you expand on that a little?
Yes, I mean, the Moore case did actually harken back to the philosophy of John Locke. It's often said that common sense relies on the insights of long-dead philosophers, and this is a good example. So the judges actually referred to Locke's idea of mixing your labour with a substance to create a property in it. So, for example, if I plant a patch of grain or something like that, and I plant it, I weed it, I harvest it, what's usually said is that it's my labour which is mixed with the land and the seed to create my property in the grain. That's at least Locke's view. And that's exactly what the court was saying in Moore, that it was Gould and his employers and the research associates with him who had put relevant skill and labour into creating the property. And actually, when you think about what Locke does say, I'm actually a philosopher by training, so you know this is something that has interested me for some time. Locke never says that it's because we have a property in our bodies as bodies that gives us this right. It's the fact that the agency that we display in the work gives us this right. So it's, as he says, it's the work of our hands, not the hands themselves,
sure,
that gives us this right. That is exemplified in lots of other areas of what I have called body shopping, by which I mean the commercialization of the human body from before conception to after death. So that, for example, patents are a big area.
Let's get on to patents now then. So there's been in people's consciousness, I think, of the listeners of this show quite a lot, a couple of ideas. Certainly people will be familiar with the idea of patenting crops and
yes,
things like that. But what we're looking at here particularly is the idea of patenting genes.
Yes, that's right. What we're looking at is the fact that as of the end of 2007, 1 in 5 human genes was actually the subject of a private patent, which is a terrific number of genes. And you may say, well, that's just academic. What does that matter? Well, it matters a lot because firms who take out patents can, if they choose, and they don't all choose, and researchers don't all choose, but some do, to take out a restrictive patent by which they can limit competition. So, for example, we had a case in the UK with the drug Herceptin, which is a drug that's used in some breast cancers, and it's used for a particular type of breast cancer which is linked to a particular gene called the HER2 gene. The patent on the drug Herceptin is held by a particular company which also holds a patent on the gene. And that means that no competitor can develop a cheaper product because they can't have access to the gene without the permission of the company, which, of course, it's not in the company's interest to give. So we've had a situation where Herceptin was ruled to be too expensive for our NHS to be able to afford by the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, which makes such judgments and decides what drugs we can afford. And it was not really brought out very much at the time that this isn't just a fact of life, this is a fact of patenting. It's not a natural price, in a sense. It's an inflated monopoly price, which could be charged in that situation because of the monopoly on the gene. And there have been other similar instances where genetic patents, for example, on the genes, this is again a breast cancer example, the genes BRCA1 and BRCA2, which are implicated in other kinds of breast cancers, those genes are patented by a US firm. And that means that in the US, where the patent is upheld, as it hasn't actually been in Europe, those genes now cost women who need to be tested for them, for the adverse variant, up to $3,000 for a test. Which obviously, you know, means that if you haven't got health insurance or your insurer won't cover it, you have a problem. So these are really massive examples. At the moment, there's a very big case going on in the US where the American Civil Liberties Union and various medical lawyers are trying to challenge these patents on BRCA1 and BRCA2 and limit the damage that can be done to patients by this particular form of body shopping, by patenting as a form of body shopping.
Again, we can look at the concepts of work here because clearly what's being sort of painted here is the research that's been done once the gene has been sort of identified. Because there's an interesting distinction that these people are not patenting the gene in the body, but an identical version of it that's been created in a lab. Is that correct?
Yes, that's exactly right, yeah.
So then what's happening is the scientists are inventing these various tests for different forms of breast cancer, and that is what's being patented. And that in itself, just on the table there, doesn't sound as bad as the concept of patenting the actual gene that we have within the body. But then as you've demonstrated, there are various examples of where companies are standing in the way of progress.
That could certainly be argued, and it has been argued in the case that I was just talking about. I think there are two things here. Yes, you might say it's perfectly reasonable that if a company develops a test or a drug like Herceptin, that it should be able to take out a patent on the test or the equipment used in the test or the drug, because otherwise it would have no incentive to invest in research. And you could argue the toss there, but you could also see that that would be more reasonable than taking out the patent on the gene itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think a lot of people find difficult to understand is how they can take out a patent that seems, first of all, to be a patent on life. That's, you know, something that's often used as a criticism. But I think also more accurately, perhaps, the difficulty is this. When these companies take out patents on, as you said, a cloned version of a gene that's produced in the laboratory, the standard that's used in patent judgments is whether that's an invention rather than a discovery. That is, there has to be an element of novelty, and it has to be something that the ordinary person couldn't just have discovered. You have to have the background knowledge. Now, that is less and less the case with the widespread, massive genome sequencing that we have had since the development of the Human Genome Project, when the whole of the human genome was sequenced. And it's now the case that these techniques are not really new. They're not really inventions. And very often they simply involve reading off computer printouts and sequences and so forth in a way that is not, it's debatable at least, as to whether it really is a new discovery. The other difficulty, I think, is this paradox, really. It's almost like a philosophical paradox. That is, if I wanted to be tested for the BRCA1 or BRCA2 gene, and I had to pay the $3,000 to the US company that holds the patent, that would be very odd, because what I want to be tested on is the gene in my body, not the gene in the lab. So there really is a sort of paradox here. They have, yes, ownership rights over the gene in the lab, the cloned version, but that's not what interests me. What interests me is the gene in my body. So there really is, I think, quite a tension there, as well as massive practical implications of these patents.
Okay, I want to move on to look at a lot of the issues looked at in the book center around reproduction and reproductive issues, and, mm-hmm. and these things obviously disproportionately, it would seem, affect the women of the world and the women's side of the reproduction issue. So let's have a look at some of these issues. I'd like to look at the issues behind the widespread harvesting of eggs, mm-hmm. first of all. You talk a lot about the dangers inherent in this that are not necessarily that widely known.
Okay. Well, there was a very hard-hitting article in the Sunday Times by Lois Rogers, which brought out these dangers very coherently and in a very, you know, telling manner, I thought. There are certain forms of stem cell research, really only one form, not all forms. There's five or six different forms. But there is one form which requires eggs. And the way in which it uses human eggs is that the eggs are enucleated, that is, the nucleus is taken out, and an adult bodily cell is put in. So if you were, for example, to donate a body cell for this purpose, and if the technique worked, and I have to hasten to say it hasn't yet worked, that you would then be donating your body cell in the hope of developing a sort of personal spare parts kit that was tissue matched to you. There wouldn't be any tissue rejection problems. And if stem cell research advanced to the point where, let's say, blood or soft tissues or even organs could eventually be produced that would match your own bodily tissues, that could obviously be of tremendous value. And there was a claim 4 years ago, which you may remember, some of the listeners may remember, by a Korean scientist who had done exactly that. His name was Hwang Woo-suk. And he claimed that he had developed 11 such lines, which would have eventually been able to be used by the donors of the body cells, the 11 people whom they matched. In that process, Hwang initially claimed that he had used a very small number of human eggs, a tiny number. And many of us were suspicious because we knew that the technique was exactly the same, except that it didn't extend to reproductive cloning, as the Dolly technique, the Dolly the sheep technique. And with Dolly, in order to create one Dolly, we knew that 400 sheep eggs had been used. So we were very suspicious of Hwang's figures, which was something like 250 eggs for 11 stem cell lines. Just didn't add up. And we subsequently discovered that he had used over 2,200 eggs. He had used eggs from his junior researchers, which obviously, you know, that brings all sorts of problems about potential coercion into the equation. And he had also bought in eggs from women elsewhere outside Korea. So there was a commerce developing in human eggs, which we found, many of us found, quite distressing. And what was most distressing was that Hwang did not succeed in creating any cell lines. But what it did do was, first of all, to show that if that technique were possible, there would be, you know, many people interested in going down that line. And secondly, the enormous numbers of eggs that would be required. And if you remember last year, at the time that we were having the passage in this country of the Human Fertilization and Embryology Bill, there was a big debate about whether we should use animal eggs, because human eggs are difficult to obtain for the reasons that you first enunciated, that is, the dangers to women in donating them. And the dangers are threefold. You first of all have to shut down the woman's natural reproductive cycle using a drug, normally using a drug called leuprolide acetate, Lupron is the brand name, which has been found by the American Food and Drug Administration to be dangerous in many forms and to be off-label for that purpose. Secondly, you then have to stimulate the woman to produce more eggs because the human female is programmed by nature to produce one or at most two per cycle. But you have to produce very many more if you're going to satisfy the demands of this form of stem cell research, which I just want to repeat is only one form. There are other alternative forms which I think are both safer and more promising. So it's not a choice between this and nothing. But there have been reports in the US, at least, of cases in which up to 70 eggs were extracted. And if that is done, and responsible clinicians would not do that, but there are these reports, then women risk what is called ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, which has, in some cases, been fatal. And then the final stage is that you have to extract the eggs under anesthetic. So it's a complicated procedure, and it seems to me that the risks do need to be brought out. That's why I'm glad to see articles like the Sunday Times one. And we also need, I think, to go down the routes of stem cell research, which don't require that. And luckily, it seems at the moment that there is another technique in particular called induced pluripotent stem cells using adult stem cells that are reprogrammed to create exactly the same thing, a personal spare parts kit of the sort that we were initially talking about. And it does seem to me that if these techniques are more promising and don't have the massive risks to women that the somatic cell technique does, that we ought to go down that route. It's not a choice between the enucleated egg method and no stem cell research at all, as tended to be presented in the debates last year. That really is not the case, and it's not the case that those of us who are worried about the risks to women are opposed. I'm not at all to all forms of stem cell research. We're not Luddites. We are pro-science, but we also think that there is an important ethical question that needs to be looked at.
I want to pick you up on that point again in a moment, but you just mentioned the hyperstimulation syndrome problem, which is extremely dangerous. But you mentioned this idea that somebody somewhere has taken possibly 70 eggs from one person. Now, it's known that women only produce a certain amount of eggs over the course of their life. So what possible other dangers would there be of taking that many eggs from a person?
Yes, that is an interesting question. The American situation is that at least as far as eggs being bought and sold for IVF, for in vitro fertilization, for fertility treatments, it is allowable to buy and sell eggs with no restriction on the quantity, because the legislation holds that both sperm and eggs are infinitely renewable tissue. Now, that is true of sperm, but it's not actually true of eggs. So the legislation, which doesn't allow other organs to be sold because they're finite, does actually allow eggs to be sold, and yet the majority of scientific research does indicate that baby girls are born with all the egg follicles that they will ever have, and that no further eggs can be developed, no further follicles can be developed. So that, to me, indicates that, yeah, there is a finite number. We don't necessarily know about the risks of premature menopause. I think the jury may still be out on that one. But the assumption that eggs are the same as sperm and that we can take and take and take without any knock-on effects, I think, is clearly wrong.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Professor Donna Dickinson about body shopping. So, Donna, before we move on, I just wanted to go back quickly to, we were just talking about stem cell research, and you mentioned that although there were various issues that are raised, it's not something that you're against per se. And leaving aside the story you've already told about Professor Woo-Suk, and there are various religious reasons why people are against the idea of stem cell research, and we won't go there at all because that doesn't concern us. But I was interested to see in the book you talk a lot about how a lot of these ideas behind the treatments that might come from stem cell research, and things like this idea of the spare part kit that you can keep, and how it's useful to have your own, like a genetic match of your, you know, your own cells, how a lot of this stuff is actually quite oversold in its benefits.
Yeah. I mean, we're looking at very profound dreams here, aren't we? We're looking at the sort of fountain of youth dream. And that is obviously very powerful. One thing I suggest at the end of the book, actually, which is the section where I do look at these sorts of issues particularly, is that because we are witnessing a sort of failure of the grand enlightenment dreams about progress and rationality and, you know, the sorts of dreams of human control over the environment in beneficial ways, instead we are witnessing disastrous human effects on the environment. So it seems to me that in many ways we are turning inward. We're looking at ways in which we can extend our own lives. We're really concentrating all of that sort of evangelical hope that might have applied in the 18th century to the idea of social progress on individual health and well-being and on long life. Because as you say, in the, as I think you were saying anyway, in the absence of religious visions, you know, we tend to concentrate more on secular things. At least that's what I would say. I'm not sure whether you would agree. So it seems to me that you can present body shopping in that light. And in that light, it looks, you know, that's a rather more charitable light. But on the other hand, it's a confusing thing because we're facing a situation in which, first of all, the law says that we don't, as we were talking about at the beginning, that we don't actually have rights over our bodies in the sense that we don't have rights over tissue once it's left our bodies. So we may have an exaggerated feeling about how much control we do have over our bodies. And secondly, many of these developments, stem cell research is one example. Umbilical cord blood banking is another example. Many of them have been hyped, you know, to give the public an impression that they are further along than they actually are. And while I would be entirely in favour of, you know, and very much hope that many of the developments do take place with stem cell research, I think the public as a whole may have an exaggerated view of exactly how far along we are. We don't, for example, have cures, and most stem cell scientists will tell you that cures are not in immediate prospect, and perhaps not for 10 or 20 years. But obviously people would very much like to believe that they are. So I think those factors have combined really to give us this rather exaggerated view of what can be achieved. And they are particularly powerful, I think, these dreams about the fountain of youth, when we hold them not just on our own behalf, but on behalf of our children or our children's children, as, for example, in this phenomenon of private umbilical cord blood banking, where parents or grandparents pay private firms to bank the baby's cord blood, umbilical cord blood, in the hope that stem cell research will eventually devise uses for it that will be like that personal spare parts kit. So, you know, obviously it's an extremely emotional area, which I think it is very difficult for us to get, you know, a realistic appraisal about.
Let's move on to look at a couple of quite, you know, quite recent developments and things that both, on the one hand, seem quite science fiction-y, but also have, you know, quite a bit of, I think, the sort of ick factor that I think makes so many of these issues quite controversial to people. And the first one I'd like to look at is the idea of face transplants.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you talk a lot about how, you know, the face is the arbiter of our sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have a look at this idea, and let's talk about some of the issues that might develop around the, you know, the concept of having somebody else's face.
Okay. Well, in the book, I look at this as a sort of extreme example of plastic surgery, very extreme example. But I also make it clear, I hope, that this is not like, you know, having Botox or something of that kind. This is a major piece of surgery which requires lifelong immunosuppressants and is only undertaken by clinical teams in cases of very extreme disfigurements, and even then, only after some soul searching. I was actually on the clinical ethics committee of a hospital in London, which was asked to consider a hand transplant, the first human hand transplant. That's when I was at Imperial College School of Medicine. So I began thinking, this was 11 years ago, about some of the ways in which hands are a sort of halfway house, as you might say, between internal organs and the face, because the hand is, of course, also visible. It's visible to the recipient. It's visible to people around. I mean, I actually saw the first human hand transplant, and it was very obvious that it, you know, did not match. So, you know, it's always going to be other, different. So the face, I think, is even more so, for obvious reasons, in that it embodies social recognition. It embodies the way in which we are recognized by others. And therefore, I don't think we will ever be entirely at ease with this phenomenon. If you looked at the reporting of the first face transplant, which was on a French woman called Isabelle Dinois, who had been mauled by a dog, and if you looked at her own reactions, it was really very interesting, because she said at one point that her brain had taken on two faces. That is, she recognized both herself in her previous pictures and her current self. And structurally, that is partly because the final face that results is an amalgam. It's not just the recipient's face, and it's not just the donor's face. The recipient's underlying bone structure makes a difference, as does the transplanted face. But it will always obviously be both to its recipient and to the people who encounter it, including the family of the donor, which I think is quite interesting. But I just want to say that with face transplants, we're not actually looking at the same phenomenon of body shopping in a way, because this is not a commercial project. It's not a commercial venture.
No.
I mean, it will never be, because the rejection rate is quite substantial. It was initially thought in the initial consultation by the Royal College of Surgeons on this subject that the rejection rate would be 1 in 2, which is terrible. So you wouldn't do it unless you really, really had to do it.
Well, we're quickly running out of time, but just to finish off, you mentioned a while ago at the end of the book, you talk about a sort of 21st century secular age in which people are perhaps looking upon their, you know, their possession of their own bodies and what they do with their bodies as differently to how people did in the past. Mm-hmm. And what would you say the essential ethical difficulties are with as treating our own bodies as a commodity, as our capital?
Yes, I think this really is an ethical difficulty. It's also a sort of metaphysical difficulty. Are we our bodies? Most people would say yes, I mean, in the obvious sense that, you know, my body is not your body. But on the other hand, we also talk about getting our bodies into shape or something like that, as if they were separate. And when you look at particularly the sale of parts of the body, then that instrumentalization of the body really does come to the fore. So if you're talking as someone who is committed to free markets in tissue, you would want to say, I have a right to sell my tissue, to do whatever I want with it. The law is wrong not to view it as mine. It is mine, and I have the right to sell it if I so choose, regardless, let's say, of the risks to me as an egg donor, if I'm a woman selling eggs. Now, many people would find that quite straightforward, but I think it isn't philosophically straightforward at all. It relies on a view of the body as being like some sort of factory good, so that, you know, when Marx, for example, talks about the objectification or the commodification of things, he simply means making them useful to humans, taking them on as objects, and attaching an exchange value to them, making them commodities. And there's nothing actually wrong with that in itself in the Marxist framework. It's the way in which it's done in exploitative relations of production, which mean that the people who sell their labor and so forth don't get the right price for it. I think it's much more complicated than that with the body, because the body is not a thing like any other. I mean, I can exist apart from any other piece of property, my house or savings account or car or anything. I could exist without all of this, but I can't exist apart from my body. So how can it simply be an object of property like any other? And I do wrestle with this quite a lot, because there has been a lot of interesting philosophical treatment of it, also in the French system, someone like Merleau-Ponty. So I really try to wrestle with it quite hard at the end, and I'm not sure that I come up with an answer that I'm satisfied with, but I am very clear, I think, that I'm not satisfied with the simple answer that says, my body, my property, because it's much more complicated than that.
That's a perfectly profound moment for us to end on. I'm Neil Denny, you're listening to Little Atoms, and I've been talking to Professor Donna Dickinson about body shopping. Donna, thanks very much for speaking to me
today.
Thank
you very much, Neil.